Hey everybody, and welcome back to another week at the Damage Report. I'm John Adirola. It's Monday, and you know what that means.
Best day ever.
Yes.
Sorry, for once, I am looking at the wrong camera. That never happens.
Oh wow, okay. Well, it was the best day ever, but now it's ruined.
That happens
but anyway,
all the time.
I'm glad to have you here.
I'm glad to be here.
And you know, the only thing that can approach the excitement that I have for her being here today is our guest, a little bit later on, Nina Turner. Does anybody get us as fired up when we talk to them as Nina Turner?
No, I am a big Nina Turner fan.
She's really a good communicator. She just gets your
senator.
What's that?
I said I do really like the senator.
Exactly, and so we're gonna have her on in a little bit to talk about Medicare for All, Bernie Sanders' primary campaign, new policy for Veterans Day, a number of different topics. But beyond that, we've got the first returns from Mike Bloomberg. What do the American people think about his potential run for the presidency? Also, Amy Klobuchar throws Pete Buttigieg under the bus. But is she actually wrong?
That's not what happened. She did not throw him under the bus.
Oh, we're gonna see.
His political experience is under the level of everyone.
No, that's what I just said. But is she actually wrong?
Okay,
sometimes you throw people under the bus because that's where they should be.
Okay, sure.
So we're going to crawl under the bus. We're gonna check his carcass and see if the evidence points to him deserving to be there.
All right.
Beyond that, the Uber CEO has a take on the death of Jamal Khashoggi that is mind blowing.
Yeah.
Just crazy.
But very common.
From people in his sort of position?
Mm-hmm.
Yes. So look, there's obviously a lot coming. It's gonna be really fun, so stick around. But before that, we have a retirement, so let's get to that. Republican Congressman Peter King is the latest in a long line of Republicans who are not going to be running for re-election in this upcoming election. It's like the in thing now. He's been in Congress for more than 25 years and as of this morning posted this statement saying, "I've decided not to be a candidate for re-election to Congress in 2020. The prime reason for my decision was that after 28 years of spending 4 days a week in Washington DC, it is time to end the weekly commute and be home in Seaford." Which could be true, but is also what they always say. I mean, they always say it's to spend more time with family. Maybe it's true. I don't know. 25 years is a long time. A lot can happen in that time. A lot has in the last couple of years for the Republican Party. So we can speculate about why exactly he's not going to be running. But you should understand that there's nearly 20 Republicans who already have said they're not going to be running for re-election, which is quite a lot. Especially considering how many didn't run for re-election in 2018.
Mm-hmm.
So you would think that after getting all of those people who were just not interested in being around anymore, that you would have sort of tapped out that resource. But no, there's still more, almost two dozen so far.
It's a cowardly way out because they're all going down swinging. They're all going down like with this idea that they don't want the Republicans to be mad at them.
Mm-hmm.
So I can't do this anymore. This is wild. This is too much. This is not what I signed up for. This is not what I believe in. So I cannot do this anymore. But until I leave, I'm gonna force myself to kiss the ring because I don't want all of you to be mad at me.
Yeah. Yeah, it's as an outsider, I can look at that and say that's really pathetic, and it is. But also, they would be really mad at them. Like it doesn't matter where you are in America. There's no elected Republican who is truly insulated from their entire base, at least in theory, turning on them if they turn on Donald Trump, or are even perceived to turn on Donald Trump. Like Jeff Sessions. He did that like hostage video of how much he loves Donald Trump still. And then Donald Trump turned around the next day and went to a football game with his rival. Like there is no amount of kissing the ring that you can do to necessarily to protect you like for the next 2 years.
Right,
it's
like
always going to be contingent.
Right, but like Ted Cruz makes it look really comfy, I think.
Yeah.
And so they're like, all right, it's not so bad.
Mm-hmm.
Dignity, what is that?
Yeah, yeah.
Going to that? Heaven.
I don't remember
what
dignity.
What is that? Like, you know, I'm just sorry.
So here's the thing. We're talking about him as an example of this trend, but he's also his own individual.
Yeah.
And you know, some people really sad to see him go, including Chuck Schumer, saying Peter King stood head and shoulders above everyone else. He's been principled and never let others push him away from his principles. He's fiercely loved America, Long Island, and his Irish heritage, and left a lasting mark on all three. I will miss him in Congress and value his friendship. So he would never let anyone push him away from his principles. But what are his principles? Let's talk about just a few of the standouts from his 25 years. Here's a little video putting together his takes on three different topics from like the most serious to the most sort of silly, but also kind of serious, as you'll see.
Unfortunately, we have too many mosques in this country. There's too many people who are sympathetic to radical Islam.
You had a 350-pound person who was resisting arrest. The police were trying to bring him down as quickly as possible. If he had not had asthma and a heart condition and was so obese, that almost definitely he would not have died from this. And he comes out, yes, with this new suit on.
Why did you take issue with the suit?
Because you know the image makers in the White House. Here's a president coming out at such a serious moment where he should be addressing the country on such a serious matter, and he looked like he was on his way to a party at the Hamptons. And I just thought it detracted from the seriousness of the moment. It's different, for instance, than what David Cameron, the way he addressed the British people today. It, to me, it was it did not show the seriousness of purpose that you need from a commander-in-chief at such a serious time as this.
Even when we've seen other former presidents, President Clinton, President Reagan, I believe, addressing the nation in similar attire?
At a moment like this, when the whole country is waiting to see, and the whole world is waiting to see, to me, at least he could have won whatever he wanted if he addressed the issue head on. But to come out and start talking about the economy, to me, just detracted from the seriousness of the moment. And I thought the suit was a metaphor for his lack of seriousness.
It became a metaphor.
Wait.
But because of you guys.
Also, the audacity to be sitting there with your shirt unbuttoned and not mm-hmm. having a tie on, mm-hmm. talking about like respect
uh-huh.
and the office.
Well,
talking about somebody like, bro, you look like you just got out of the pool.
Is this an attack on Andrew Yang's debate attire?
Also, no tie. At first it was, the entire segment was about him wearing a tan suit, and then he flipped it at the end when it's like, oh, but look, your hero, mm. Ronald Reagan.
Yeah. And then he tried to say, well, oh, no, it's not about the suit.
It's about, he could have worn whatever he wanted. Then why are we here?
Yeah. Yeah, it's a metaphor. It is a metaphor, but it's not a metaphor about him. It's a metaphor about the criticism of him.
Frustrating. And so this is the best we can do. I'm sorry.
Yeah, okay. Well, but it's so. No, it's fine. So we had, there's too many mosques in America. Right. And so, look, we can't go through his whole record, but he's one of the worst Islamophobes in all of Congress. But forget about that when you're eulogizing him. He occasionally was critical of Trump. So we can forget about all of that if you're Chuck Schumer. Then Eric Garner being choked out when there's not supposed to be any chokeholds. It's actually kind of Eric Garner's fault because he has asthma and because he's obese. If not for that, it would have been totally fine. That's what this great guy who's principled and never let others push him away from his principles, including standing with the police against the person, the unarmed person that they killed, that they never should have been in that situation with.
I mean, we're never gonna win when it comes to powerful people, rich people, famous people, getting along with people who cause harm to marginalized communities. We're never gonna stop that. That is gonna be a trend that is never going to end, right?
That's sad.
And I agree. I just can't see it ending.
Yeah.
What's even more frustrating is that he didn't have to send that tweet. Mm-hmm. That like no one's even really legitimately asking him to cut his friend off.
Yeah.
We're beyond that.
He didn't.
But you didn't have to rub it in a bunch of like marginalized communities in their faces. You didn't have to do that. Like every day, Chuck Schumer is one of the people that we're leaning on.
Mm-hmm.
And you didn't have to do that. That was a celebratory thing because the people who see that, they know the real. This, you could have called him and said, I think you're a good guy. I think you're a great guy. That was
great
to your
job
friend.
On the too many mosques thing.
Right.
Yeah.
That was, you know, too many places of worship.
Exactly.
Like, but.
So, but we do have.
That was just a slap in the face to people everywhere.
Well, maybe this will ease the sting then, because Representative Ilhan Omar said Peter King is an Islamophobe who held McCarthyite hearings targeting American Muslims, which he also did, by the way. Said, quote, there are too many mosques in this country, and blamed Eric Garner for his own death. Good riddance. He also proposed setting up a federal Muslim surveillance program. So bear that in mind. But you know, he's gonna go off, he's gonna retire, he can occasionally maybe get a drink with Chuck Schumer or other politicians who have supported him in the recent past, including Mike Bloomberg, who did a fundraiser for Peter King, but it was a long time ago back in, 2018. So weird, this guy who wants to be the standard bearer for all of the Democratic Party, doing fundraisers for a Republican congressman just last year in the Trump era against his Democratic challenger.
Michael Bloomberg and Donald Trump, I know, are twins when it comes to stop and frisk. Like,
exactly.
They're,
we're gonna have a lot of stop and frisk.
Yeah. Okay, you're right.
So Peter King, bye, dude. Okay, we're gonna take a short break. We come back, Nina Turner is gonna be joining us after this.
We need to talk about a relatively new show called the Republic, or UNFTR. As a Young Turks fan, you already know that the government, the media, and corporations are constantly peddling lies that serve the interests of the rich and powerful. But now there's a podcast dedicated to unraveling those lies, debunking the conventional wisdom. In each episode of the Republic, or UNFTR, the host delves into a different historical episode or topic that's generally misunderstood or purposely obfuscated by the so-called powers that be, featuring in-depth research, razor-sharp commentary, and just the right amount of vulgarity. The UNFTR podcast takes a sledgehammer to what you thought you knew about some of the nation's most sacred historical cows. But don't just take my word for it. The New York Times described UNFTR as consistently compelling and educational, aiming to challenge conventional wisdom and upend the historical narratives that were taught in school. For as the great philosopher Yoda once put it, "You must unlearn what you have learned." And that's true whether you're in Jedi training or you're uprooting and exposing all the propaganda and disinformation you've been fed over the course of your lifetime. So search for UNFDR in your podcast app today and get ready to get informed, angered, and entertained all at the same time.
Joining us now to break down the latest in the Bernie Sanders Democratic primary campaign, national co-chair of the Bernie Sanders 2020 campaign, Senator Nina Turner, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Sean. Great to be here.
Very excited to have you here. So I wanted to start off with one of the biggest issues in this primary so far, which is certainly Medicare for All. You have some candidates like Bernie Sanders who want Medicare for All, and then you have others who keep saying that that's what they want, even though they're pushing plans that don't actually get you there. So there's this tour plan, the Medicare for Y'all tour. Could you tell us about that? What's the objective there?
Yeah, really to highlight the virtues of Senator Sanders' bold plan to ensure every person in this country to recognize that we've gone wanting for generations, and that is not only asinine, it's immoral, and it doesn't even fit economically, if you will. We don't get the best outcomes for our investment as a nation in terms of the commodification of healthcare as we know it now. And so it's just really bringing down more to the grassroots level the vision that the senator has in terms of universal health care. And we did it, John, in a very exciting way this past weekend in South Carolina, our Medicare for Y'all tour with Women for Bernie, which was really a beautiful thing. So I had an opportunity to be joined by some amazing women, you know, Corey Bush from St. Missouri, also Amy Vallela from Nevada, and Paula Jean Swergen from West Virginia. And you may remember those names. Those women are highlighted in a documentary called Knock Down the House. Mm-hmm. They endorsed Senator Sanders a couple of months ago, so it was nice to be on the road with them. And then last but certainly not least, Dr. Victoria Dooley, who is a physician. She's an internist, a family medical doctor in Detroit, Michigan.
Senator Turner, hi. Again, we are excited to have you here. I want to know what has been the reception in South Carolina to the reception to Medicare for All. I feel like that's a narrative that we don't hear. We hear a lot of politicians, a lot of people saying, no, this is what the people don't want. And that never charts with me.
No, and you're absolutely right. Your gut about this is right. You know, I've been blessed to travel several states across this country, but particularly South Carolina. Medicare for All, or healthcare itself, is a number one priority for them, or one of the top three priorities for them. You know, South Carolinians pay the third highest healthcare premiums in the country. They're only third to Alaska and North Carolina. They care deeply about healthcare. And when we were doing the town halls, not only did we do town halls, we also have focus groups with women, and they talked about the need for healthcare. And we know that the healthcare outcomes, especially for Black women, are more bleak than any other group, and especially in the area of maternal healthcare. Maternal death rates are high, infant mortality. They really care deeply. And so many people told stories about not wanting to go to the hospital because they didn't have the money, or, you know, even if they had insurance, delaying some of the procedures that their doctor instructed them to have because they didn't want to have a bill.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. You know, I was watching some of the, I believe it was the Ohio campaigning with Senator Sanders and Representative Ocasio-Cortez, and she talked a little bit about the argument around funding programs like Medicare for All. She was talking about the Green New Deal too, and she really expressed the frustration I've had that every time this topic gets brought up in a debate, and it does every time, generally is the first topic, you get the question of is it gonna raise taxes and the question of how are we gonna pay for this, framing on this issue that we don't see in other topics. And it feels to me like it's an attempt to scare people off before we even get into the substance of what these programs can bring, to only be focused on the great costs that might come with it. Do you think that sort of thing, whether it's on the debate stage or when these candidates appear on CNN, MSNBC, is that going to be successful in scaring people off from learning more about Medicare for All?
No, I don't think so. You know, what is the cost to a dysfunctional healthcare system that people literally die from? What is the cost of that? And if every other industrialized nation on the face of this earth can have a universal healthcare program or system, rather, why can't we have that in the United States of America? It just boggles my mind, especially to have Democrats. And they're just flat out lying to people. We can afford it. And over a 10-year period, the healthcare plan, the Medicare for All plan that the senator is proposing is a lot cheaper with better health outcomes than what we have right now. We have a dysfunctional healthcare system that is commodified so that very few people and corporations can make lots of money at the expense of the overwhelming majority of the people in this country who cannot afford healthcare. And even if you do have healthcare, the cost of premiums, deductibles, and copays, sometimes you can't even afford, most people can't afford those. And then when you layer on top of that prescription drugs, it is almost untenable. There are almost 80 million people, a little over, probably closer to 90 million people who are either uninsured or underinsured in this country. The weight of the lack of healthcare or access to healthcare in this country, we can no longer sustain. So for any Democratic candidate that is selling the American people this BS, and I'm not talking about Bernie Sanders, you know, really shame on them, because they are flat out lying. We can afford it. We can afford to give tax breaks to multimillionaires and billionaires. And we can afford to continue to fund a military industrial complex that causes, you know, war and disruption, and again, making mega corporations wealthier at the destruction of people in other countries. If we can afford to do all those things, then my God, we can afford to have Medicare for All. And I want to make one other point on that point, which is when Medicare, and we as a country, as a nation, have been trying to move towards this since President Truman. But when Medicare was first envisioned, it was envisioned as a universal program. It was just that the political will was not there at the time. Mm-hmm. Fast forward to 2016, 2015, when we have a candidate who really has been talking about this since the 90s, but he was able to bring it to the national stage when he ran for president in 2015, when he announced his candidacy in 2015, and he ran in 2016, saying to the people of this nation, you deserve better than what you are getting. It has to be a universal program. It can't be one Medicare for choice, Medicare for some. It has to be Medicare for All, because we need everybody to have skin in the game. The only way a program like that is going to work is it has to be universal, and we can afford it. I want your viewers to know, we as a nation can afford a Medicare for All universal healthcare program.
I agree. You were talking about just a minute ago some of the awesome women that you were working with on the Medicare for Y'all tour. Of course, you've also got a few others that have recently joined onto the campaign by endorsing Bernie Sanders. There's AOC, who's with him in Ohio, but Ilhan Omar.
In
Iowa, sorry. And Ilhan Omar as well, and he recently toured a food pantry with Rashida Tlaib. These are the biggest rising stars in the party right now. What is it like to have them come out in support of his candidacy and now to be doing these trips around different parts of the country with him?
It adds another layer of excitement. You know, it really rallies our base, which is a good thing. And it also shows that all of the detractors who were talking all that nonsense against Senator Sanders, he's too old, he's too white, he's out of touch. With the symbol of all of these women, you know, the women that you named and the women that I named, and even women who don't have fancy titles and a lot of national cachet. Mm-hmm. What it says is that the women for Bernie across this country, across ethnicity, religion, you know, I want to give a shout out to my sister, Linda Sousser, you know, across all of the identities, that these women are standing up side by side saying that the vision of Senator Bernard Sanders is the vision that we believe that this country deserves, and that we're standing by his side pushing this agenda, because we know that Americans in this country deserve better than what they have been getting. The people of this nation deserve better than what they were getting. And so all the detractors, now they're gonna have to find something else to say about the senator, because it's obvious. And also, you know, there was a stat that just came out that the senator is outperforming every other candidate with, you guessed it, suburban women, hello, and donations. So, you know, they're gonna have to find something else to try to attack the senator on. And it's going to be pretty hard, because he is really, as Cori Bush put it, we rocking with him because he rocking with us. And women across this nation, whether it's their pocketbook, teachers, Walmart workers, or whether it's the fine women that you just named, we are standing side by side with the senator, and we want to see his progressive vision become a reality for people in this nation.
That sounds good to me. Let's turn to one other topic, though. For a long time, Bernie Sanders has been talking about the millionaires and the billionaires, and how he's got these new plans that might negatively impact some of those billionaires. They don't necessarily like that. And so we've already had a couple of billionaires in the race. As of this week, it looks like we might get another with Mike Bloomberg entering in. And if he wants to, he could spend $1 billion running this primary. He could spend $10 billion. He could spend whatever he wants, more than God could spend. Should Bernie Sanders supporters be worried about Mike Bloomberg potentially entering this Democratic primary?
No, they should not. You know, this is a democracy. So, you know, far be it for me to tell people not to run. But this is not the synergistic moment for this. We are tired. We, the collective, we are just really over people believing that they can buy elections. And unfortunately, you know, for too long in this country, people actually could buy elections. Yeah. But I believe that people there's an awakening going on in our country and all across the world. And we do need campaign finance reform. This is just another clear indication of how broken this system is, and the arrogance of the billionaire class to think that they can swoop in and save everybody. They are out of touch. They do not have a clue. And what this is going to do, I think, is really strengthen the people who do believe that we need a political revolution in this country. And what is meant by that is to force the levers of government, be they federal, state, regional, or local, but force the levers of government to bend to the will of the people. And the level of government that has the biggest stick in being able to do that is the federal level of government. And it's time, it's past time to have a candidate, to have a leader, to make sure that the 46th president of the United States of America is somebody who will not equivocate, somebody who is not bought and sold by the billionaire class, somebody who is funded by the people. And that candidate is Senator Bernard Sanders. So no, we shouldn't worry. It's just gonna rev us up more to do what it is we need to do. So bring it on.
Senator Nina Turner, as always, thank you so much for joining us. We really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was such a pleasure to be with both of you. Oh, and just happy Veterans Day to our veterans.
Yes.
Oh my God, past, present, and future, for everything that you all do and your family sacrifice so that we can have the liberties that we have and have the luxury to have these kinds of conversations. So just thank all the veterans and their families for everything that you do.
Agreed.
Thanks thank for being so here.
Thank you. I look forward to next time.
Me too. And by the way, related to that, Bernie Sanders did put out a plan dealing with a number of different issues facing veterans. So if you want to go and look out, the details on the plan are available. Perhaps we can do a rundown on them a little bit later in the week. But that is out there, and time for Veterans Day. We're going to take a short break. When we come back, lots more to get to.
He's had a different experience. We should be able to have those debates about candidates without being accused of being negative.
So that is Amy Klobuchar being asked about the political experience, the path to the candidacy that Pete Buttigieg has had, because he went from earlier this year, nobody, even many of the people in his own town didn't know who he was, to now he's at 8%. And the media, maybe not right now, but earlier in the race, were pretty big fans. He was getting a lot of glowing coverage. And Amy Klobuchar, I think, is echoing a number of people's sort of bewilderment at that so far. And so we're going to have a little bit more where she goes a little bit farther. But that seems fair to point out, right?
Yeah, it is fair. I think that if he was of what he says he is and what he says he's fighting for, then he would come out and say, no, you're right. Mm-hmm. I think Bernie would say, you're right. I think that all of the men on the stage, like, and she goes into it, right? But like, he does have an advantage. He's a white man in America.
What do you mean an advantage?
Over women.
I get the bias, yes.
I don't have a problem with somebody not having a lot of experience being given an opportunity. Mm-hmm. But
totally, yeah. Well, why don't we play the part that's getting a lot more controversial news coverage, because I want to talk about that, because I have a nuanced opinion on political experience. But here she is talking about the standard for those who've made it onto the stage. Mm-hmm.
Of the women on the stage, I'm focusing here on my fellow women senators, of Senator Harris, Senator Warren, and myself. Do I think that we would be standing on that stage if we had the experience that he had? No, I don't. Maybe we're held to a different standard.
Okay, so she's pointing out the different standard for what qualifies you to be up there. Is that a fair comment to make?
That's a completely fair comment to make.
And she's right.
Yeah, I mean, she herself, as a white woman, has an advantage over Kamala. Nobody calls Amy Klobuchar a cop.
Yes.
True. Nobody does. Nobody. Uh-huh. They don't criticize her. She's not held to the same standard as someone with the same job. Nobody considers her.
Do you think that part of that might be that, like, at any given time, she's polling at like 1/8 of what Kamala Harris is?
No. I think it's because she's not a black woman.
I feel like we focus on people more as. I agree.
No, it has nothing to do, because people were riding for Marianne Williamson. Mm-hmm. Like, you know what I mean? Like,
some.
Like, right.
Well, okay. Well, so, for instance, Pete Buttigieg is getting criticized a ton, mainly from TYT, for
and
his
all of
effect
the black
criminal
people in the city
exactly,
that he ran.
Exactly. So, and I mean, the reporters are going in.
We're just giving them a voice. All of those people, you know?
Yeah. Exactly.
He said himself, I couldn't get it done. He said himself, we saw a video of him back and forth with a black person from his town saying, you're not going to get my vote. And he said, I don't want it. I'm not trying. Like, that was weird. And then we got that memo that kind of implied that black people were inherently homophobic. And he's just not, it's not working. Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah.
there's a disconnect.
Yeah. So just a couple things fast on that. So with Klobuchar's comment, I agree there is a different standard to get up there. And I guess, like, we should remember that before this Democratic primary, there's never been this many women as either first tier or second tier candidates for the presidency in a Democratic primary. It's never, like, you could almost name all of them. You had Hillary Clinton for a while, you had Carol Moseley Braun, and maybe a couple of others, I guess. But there has not been a lot. Now,
you mean like recent? Like,
I'm saying in Democratic primaries for the presidency that I can think going back, where you had, like, I mean, now several have dropped out, but you had Gillibrand and Harris and Klobuchar and Tulsi Gabbard, and, like, you know, not all of them are polling at, you know, more than 2 or 3%, but are considered serious candidates. But I still think she's right to point out that there's still a different standard. Pete Buttigieg was the mayor of, you know, not the smallest of towns, but a small town. How many mayors are there
also,
of comparable stature?
Also, he did a bad job at it. That's really what this
well,
is
exactly.
about. He did a bad job at it. There's a big.
Was he the one that is instantly elevated running for the presidency?
I truly believe, I would like to hear his reaction, not his supporters, who are so, like, I know, we can't, like, put like one blanket over everyone, but some of his supporters were loudly upset about this comment, like online. I would like to hear what Pete Buttigieg thinks about this, because I would hope that he would agree with her.
Yeah.
If
it would be savvy of him,
if he's truly, you know, progressive and he's honest and he wants to fight for marginalized communities, then he would say, yeah, you're right.
Yeah.
That doesn't mean that one, because again, we both have, I think, similar views on, like, kind of like, you have to know that to have a lot of political experience, like, not everybody was even able to obtain that.
Mm-hmm.
So it shouldn't count you out.
Yeah, and look, I think you should get in based on bold ideas.
Yeah, exactly.
And sometimes you have those bold ideas and you've been in the Senate for a long time. And some, like, Andrew Yang got a lot of people excited. He has no political experience whatsoever. And I don't think a lot of people are saying he shouldn't be allowed on there. It's just that we're able to look at a candidate like Buttigieg and be like, why him out of the literally hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of mayors that hypothetically could have gone there?
Right.
Would the media have responded to all of them the same if they were different in one of another ways. Anyway, I think that's a fair question to ask.
Yeah.
Okay, why don't we move?
Yeah, we can move on. Let's move on. Yeah,
right. We'll come back to it more in the future, but I know that you wanted to talk about
our
this.
Our desks are really close to each other. We can finish this later.
That's true. No, let's not talk off camera. I would like to avoid that. So let's move ahead to the next topic. Mike Bloomberg just might be running for the presidency. We've now had a couple of days where some polls ran, and we get to see how he's doing. But before we show you that, the reception to the idea of Mike Bloomberg running has not necessarily been glowing across the spectrum. And you showed me the New York Times, Charles Blow had a piece reminding people of one of the biggest policy related issues with Mike Bloomberg, which is his enthusiastic near religious support for stop and frisk. So to give you an idea, in 2002, the first year that Bloomberg was mayor, there was almost 100,000 of those stops, which already sounds like a lot. But during his tenure, it surged to nearly 700,000 by 2011. Nearly 90% of the people who were stopped and frisked were innocent of any wrongdoing.
90%.
I think it was 88% were innocent.
This was just traumatizing young black and Hispanic boys and young men. That was it.
By design, effectively. Right. In 2009, there were more than 580,000 stop and frisk, a record at the time. Of those stopped, 55% were black, 32% Hispanic, only 10% white. Most were young, almost all were male, 88% were innocent. And before you go to the Wikipedias, that is not the demographic breakdown in the area. It was skewed, obviously, to achieve its goal,
right, but
whether stated or otherwise.
To look at that, like almost 600,000, more than half of them were black. Looking at the population numbers in that area, I think Charles Burrow also pointed out that out of black men between the ages of boys and men, excuse me, between the ages of I think 13 and 34, there was something around 300,000. Mm-hmm. So put that number, it seems like every single black person between the black male between the ages of 13 and 34 was stopped.
He said like on average it's each person was stopped once a year effectively.
And it's like
just crazy.
Idea that people I don't think realize how awful of an experience that is. Like think about just how frustrating it is going through the airport, which is such a privilege, and how when you have to get like a pat down, how shaken that is. And imagine just riding your bike home from school and a police officer pulling up, grabbing you, throwing you up against the wall, and then rubbing you down essentially.
Yeah.
You didn't do anything. You're coming from math class, and then you have to walk home like shaken and just
innocent of any crime. And then, you know, even worse, they enter your name into a comprehensive police database. Even if you weren't accused of a crime, the state had to have destroyed that. So the state had to be like, oh, come on, you can't do that. The actual like rate of them finding contraband of any kind or a gun, a Columbia Law professor, Jeffrey Fagan, said it's the same as it would be if you simply chose people by chance, which they did, except manipulated by racial animus, of course.
Right.
And so look, I get that like it's in a Democratic area, and so a lot of people just forget that it happened. But imagine if Trump proposed this now.
He did.
We're gonna do this.
I
know we should respond the same.
That the Supreme Court was like, hey guys, actually after all of this time, this is unconstitutional.
Yeah.
Whoa.
We should respond the same.
It didn't help crime. Mm-hmm. Crime was atrocious.
It would be wrong even if it did.
Exactly.
But it didn't.
Now that we're not traumatizing people, crime is actually better. They figured out different ways because this wasn't working.
Yeah.
It wasn't working. It was just costing innocent human beings because they were black and Hispanic.
Yeah.
And it's just, Charles Bill also pointed out that people in New York were so frustrated by Bloomberg that they proudly voted in Bill de Blasio.
Yeah, who has, the crime has gone down at the same time that the stop and frisks have gone down significantly. Yeah. And so far, how is this helping him? Well, in certain areas, the stop and frisk might be good for him, but nationally, not so much. He's at 4% if he were to be running, supposedly, which actually is better than some of the other candidates, shockingly, but not necessarily gonna shoot him into the top tier. Maybe his history plus $100 million in advertising. Maybe that will do it for him. But so far, and by the way, nearly 25% of likely primary voters view him unfavorably, the highest disapproval rating of everyone running. He does the worst out of anyone amongst young voters. His best he does amongst those over 65 who are conservative, who I think should be the target audience of Democratic primaries, I think.
I just can't.
Conservative 80-year-olds.
Being this rich and
this out of touch?
Bored.
I can't imagine it, but I'd like to. So let's do a social
experiment. My life would be so nice if I had that much money. You know what I would not be doing?
Running for president?
Right.
Probably not.
What?
Yeah.
I would be funding a political candidate that I believed in.
The Rock.
And laying at the pool.
Yeah.
Okay?
More so that, probably.
Laying at
that
pool.
Point.
That's what I would do.
Oh, I would be so comfortable. I wouldn't have a sore back at all. Anyway, so Bloomberg, have fun. It's probably not going to last a very long time. You're going to waste a ton of money that could be better spent.
Why? But the two of them, the two billionaires, give this money to a candidate.
They're very bored, like you said.
It's so unfair.
Okay, we have to take a short break. We come back. Uber CEO making maybe even a worse decision than Mike Bloomberg after this. Uber's CEO was recently interviewed by Axios. It was asked about the presence on Uber's board of a Saudi official. And considering the Saudi government's ordering of the killing of Jamal Khashoggi, should that situation potentially change? This is how he responded.
But from your opinion, he represents and works for a government which you believe had a role in the murder of a journalist who was a US resident. Should that person be on the board of a US company?
I think that government said that they made a mistake.
Well, they made a mistake, and somebody's dead.
Listen, it's a serious mistake. We've made mistakes too, right? With self-driving, and we stopped driving, and we're recovering from that mistake. So I think that people make mistakes. It doesn't mean that they can never be forgiven. I think they've taken it seriously.
And the CIA didn't suggest that they made a mistake and that it was an oversight. Like with self-driving, that was basically a bad sensor, correct? The CIA suggested that the Crown Prince had a role in ordering an assassination. It's a different thing. You guys didn't intentionally run somebody over.
I didn't read that part of the CIA report. You're obviously deeper in it. But I think from a Saudi perspective, they're just like any other shareholder, right? Now we're a public company. Anyone can invest in our company if they choose to do so. And they're a big investor, just like you could be a big investor as well.
Okay, so there's a lot there. I would say, I think the most honest thing that was said there from the point of view of the CEO of Uber was, they're just like any other investor. At the end of the day, I mean, okay, so maybe they assassinated someone, but there's a lot of money. The sovereign wealth fund is the fifth largest shareholder in Uber. I mean, that's a significant sum of money.
Yeah.
It just happens to be tied to a regime that goes around and kills its political opponents and members of the media.
Yeah.
What'd you think about that? That it was a mistake? And look, we believe that people can be forgiven for mistakes, right? So is he really wrong?
What happens when you behave like this is you go the way of the NBA, that when you do something right,
mm-hmm.
like the rules just get so ridiculous that when you slip and just simply disagree with them on something that you happen to believe in, unfortunately somebody's death and someone's like an actual human being chopped up.
Yeah.
And secretly, you know, taken out in pieces. That's not something that a lot of people care about, unfortunately.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't care. None of this support ever matters.
Mm-hmm.
Like, it's just fascinating. Like, these companies are willing to just kind of bow down, and it doesn't get you anything. You mm-hmm. have to continuously bow down over and over and over again.
Yeah.
Because you make one misstep, and they're like, sorry, no thanks, we're done with you.
Mm-hmm.
So it's like, I don't know, I just think, am I making any sense? I just think it's not even worth it.
What is not worth it?
Like, to not come out strong against what happened.
Yeah. Yeah, well, look, initially they didn't take part in this big gathering
mm-hmm.
there. That was courageous, I guess. I don't know. But now to sort of back off and say, what are you going to do? Anybody can be an investor.
Yeah.
Okay, maybe. But you control what you say. And he decided to say, and we're gonna get to his updated statement in a second.
Yeah.
But that it's a mistake and anyone can be forgiven. Well, look, I would say if there's anyone who gets to decide if Mohammed bin Salman gets forgiven for this, I don't think it's someone with a direct financial incentive to do the forgiving. You as the Uber CEO, you have no connection to that. As far as I know, you didn't even know this person. You're not related to this person. You don't get to decide whether the person who ordered their brutal murder gets forgiven. And it's just so self-serving to put it in those terms. Now, apparently, as soon as Dara Khosrowshahi, I hadn't actually said that name before, but after finishes the interview, says, you know what, that's probably not gonna play well. So here's the updated statement. CEO said, I said something in the moment that I do not believe. When it comes to Jamal Khashoggi, his murder was reprehensible and should not be forgotten or excused. There's no forgiving or forgetting what happened. And I was wrong to call it a mistake. As I told Dan Primack after our interview, I said something in the moment I don't believe. Our investors have long known my views here, and I'm sorry I wasn't as clear on Axios.
Okay, well then I'm fine with that.
Yeah, that's okay, but like you weren't as clear.
No,
it wasn't a muddled message. It was an incredibly amoral, self-serving business message.
His apology didn't, the beginning of it didn't match up with the end, but the beginning was there. Mm-hmm. And at this point, that's all I'm asking for. Just being willing to speak out against something that you believe is wrong.
Okay. Well, as of today at least, boycott Uber is trending on Twitter.
There's a long list of reasons. Like whatever gets you.
Yeah, that's true. It's not the only thing.
Right?
That's so weird. And really fast, I've been watching Silicon Valley.
Okay.
And they have this like business prospect that involves getting in bed with the family of a dictator who made their money through murdering people. How timely.
Right.
You didn't think you'd see that in the tech world, but apparently you will. Okay, let me know what you think about that. We're gonna take a short break. When we come back, a little bit of good news to close out the show. Good news in Chicago, as of right now, the city will no longer be shutting off a resident's water supply because of unpaid utility bills, which is an absolute nightmare and crisis in other parts of the country. Mayor Lori Lightfoot said access to water is a basic human right that too many Chicagoans have had to go without because they have had to choose between paying the utility bills and paying for other needs. This new policy will also provide pathways for residents to settle their utility debts by paying a discounted rate of 50% for water service, sewer, and water sewer tax bills. After 1 year of meeting the discounted payments, the city would forgive previously incurred debt. And on this policy change, the mayor said, our families deserve to live their lives without the constant financial stress imposed by city government. They need a pathway to compliance to be able to pay their bills. And I get that people need to pay their bills, mm-hmm. but the idea that in America we would cut off people's literal water.
Yeah, but we do that and we've done, this is.
We do, and it's happening in Detroit, son, yeah.
Yeah, water, electricity, things that we shouldn't, like kids shouldn't have to experience this because their parents are struggling to pay, you know, to pay their bills. This is fantastic. Mm-hmm. And I wish everybody across the country would adopt this.
Yeah, yeah, and we see, I think, like this sort of approach where we believe that government, like there's a lot of people come in and say, government should be run like a business.
Right.
Okay, that's one way to do it. Another is that government should recognize the fundamental humanity of everyone lives in the country.
Hello.
And should not arrange itself in a way that increases the likelihood that people will starve to death, get exposed to winter, those sorts of things.
Right. And people are like, oh, nobody's gonna pay for their water now. That's ridiculous. It's not gonna happen like that. And people aren't not paying their water bill because they, you know, they just, they can. They just want fun money. They can't afford it. And this is gonna help those people.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's people from the outside looking at that and saying, ah, these people are probably just buying fun stuff, like you said. They're just they're buying drugs, or they're just having fun rather than paying their obligation. And it's unfortunately, it's the product of decades of right-wing media teaching people to not see other groups, especially in other parts of the country, as human. You're willing to look at them and say, well, they're not actually like me. They're not reacting to a financial crisis the way I would. They're just being irresponsible.
Yep.
And I appreciate politicians changing that approach at least somewhat. Now, this is also, there was a similar policy change back in July. Lightfoot said similar reforms would be made to the city's parking ticket program when she announced the city would stop suspending drivers' licenses for unpaid tickets and make it easier for drivers to access payment plans to settle ticket debt. And the thing is, if you don't have water in your house, it becomes very difficult to live.
Right.
If you can't drive, it becomes fundamentally more difficult to pay off your parking tickets. If you can't get to work because you can't drive, or if you suddenly need to pay for transportation every day. Like you've experienced having to use Uber and it's pretty expensive. And if you already can't meet your financial obligations, let's not make it more difficult for you to do so. Like locking people up, that makes it more difficult for them to pay off their debts when they lose their job because they're in prison for a week.
I agree.
It's a fundamental difference in approach to government, and I like to see people, like we had this era of compassionate conservatism and you know the values Republicans and things like that. They value different things. I appreciate people who value humanity and believe that government should be there to serve the interests of the people, not to be a stick that's wielded against them in every possible way. Okay, we unfortunately have very little time. Thank you as always.
Yeah, no, glad to be here. I'm glad we got to. We had a good show today.
We did, and we had Nina Turner, which is always fun. That's always nice. Thank you everybody for tuning in. We don't have an overtime today or anything like that, but I did want to let you know we've been doing live videos before the live shows. So if you subscribe to us on YouTube, you can access those every day.
You gotta hit the bell too.
Also hit the bell. Exactly. Thank you, and we'll see you tomorrow morning. Thanks for listening to the full episode of The Damage Report. Support our work, listen ad-free, access members-only bonus content, and more by subscribing to Apple Podcasts at apple.co/TYT. I'm your host, John Adirola. I'll see you soon.